Lula's speech on Wednesday was the first since a Supreme Court judge overturned the corruption convictions, which put him behind bars for 18 months and stripped him of his political rights. Banned from the 2018 elections, the leader of Brazil's left-wing Workers' Party is now seen as a political threat to President Jair Bolsonaro. He says it's too soon to talk about next year's presidential race, but he spoke like a candidate. Lula blasted Bolsonaro for downplaying the COVID-19 pandemic, which has already claimed the lives of almost 270,000 Brazilians, the second largest death toll after the United States.
We have a president who says COVID-19 is a small flu, who says that only cowards fear the virus, and that he does not because he can have it. This is not the way a president should act in a civilized world.
Welcome everybody. This episode of Left Reckoning, Lula Livre, baby, Lula Livre. My name is David Griscom, and I am joined by a good friend and comrade, Matt Leck. How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing well. Hello, folks.
This is going to be a really, really packed episode. I'm excited. In a little bit, we're going to be joined by Matt Karp to talk about his most recent piece of Jacobin, which breaks down the second age of Gilded Age politics and also the very real threat of class realignment. And a little bit later, we'll also be going over how not to be a stooge for wreckers when it comes to the fight for unions across the country. In the post game, we're going to do our second edition of Bum Steer of the Week. Going to be talking about some of these academics who seem to be very, very in love with a almost cartoonish NGO character, Yaku Perez, who, by the way, people should know this, has been calling for military police action to subvert the democratic election in Ecuador. Who could have seen that coming?
He's really stormed up the asshole power rankings, I think, the last like, couple of weeks. He's been on a tear.
He's been climbing up. But we have to start with this great news that we had earlier this week, that Lula da Silva, a person who needs no introduction to this audience, has had his political rights restored, which means that he can run again against Bolsonaro. And we are getting every indication that that is going to be what he does. The tragedy of Lava Jato is starting to roll to an end, but there's going to have to be a reckoning on the other side. You know, just a quick, recap of what happened this week. The Supreme Court minister, Fachin, dismissed Lava Jato's charges against Lula. Remember, this was somebody who was once very, very, very pro Lava Jato, as we found from leaked texts that he was involved with, basically cheering on the actions of all the different prosecutors. Remember, the United States government was involved in this case, and we've seen clues from that from the very beginning. Remember, the task force also said that Lula's imprisonment was a gift from the CIA. And next week, we're going to be joined by Victor Puggi, who I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, brother. I'm sure you'll correct me next week. And we're really going to go in depth about what's going on with this change in the legal arena in Brazil and also the political scene. I'm really looking forward to that. But just right now, you know, we have to outline what happened. Why did this happen? Because there was obviously Lava Jato was an illegal and immoral investigation, and it was a political targeting of Lula da Silva because he was very clearly going to win the presidential election. They knew they could not beat him at the ballot box, so they engaged in what we now call lawfare, trying to use the courts. And this has been exposed now, that this was the strategy to create so many legal challenges for Lula that it would distract him from running the campaign and also potentially prevent him from being on the ballot. And that's what ended up happening. And it has to be understood too that why did this shift in Lula's favor now? It's because all of this nonsense that people try to act that these that the court systems are impartial and neutral is BS. What's happened here is the political calculation has shifted because Lava Jato is very unpopular now. The political calculus has changed. And also, the people involved in Lava Jato are very afraid that they are going to be facing a legal reckoning. Sergio Moro, one of the main villains of Lava Jato, who has very serious political ambitions. Remember, this is somebody who was, you know, the leader of Lava Jato and then ended up getting a position in the Bolsonaro coup government, right? He is under investigation for his illegal activity in the Lava Jato investigation. And the hope here, this is what most of the analysts and my friends in Brazil have been saying to me, the hope here is that by dropping these, you know, charges against Lula, it will also have make those other investigations against Moro and people like that lose steam as well.
Yeah, I mean, I hope Moro faces some sort of justice after all this. Go watch Edge of Democracy on Netflix. Watch just like the freakish sort of... And one of the politicians in Brazil made the comparison, like, it's like as if a judge, a right-wing judge in Texas... was tapping Obama's phone and then going to the news with the revelations, and people should applaud that as corruption fighting, clearly. Yeah. And we'll get into a little bit more of this, later in the show, I think. We'll get to Matt Harp, right now, but good news. As far as like a lot of the moderate press you'll see will say that, you know, these were just thrown out on a technicality that that court did standing. He still might face charges. And the question is, like, charges over what? As we have demonstrated and been over, there's really nothing he's guilty of.
No, nothing. And, like, literally, they couldn't even bring charges against him, clear charges, like outlining what he did wrong, because the only evidence they have are coerced statements, right? It's a complete joke and a farce. This, I mean, I'm sorry to get heated, but it's absolutely ridiculous what Lula faced. Mm-hmm. And thank God that there were so many people who immediately recognized that something was wrong, including our friend Michael Brooks, who, you know, I'm sure would be very, very happy and celebrating this news as well. So it's a very sweet and meaningful victory, for Brazil, the left, the globe, the poor, the working class. It's a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with Matthew Karp. We are back on Left Reckoning. David Griscom, welcoming to the show, Matt Karp. He's a contributing editor at Jacobin Magazine and associate professor emphasizing 19th century history and politics. Matt Karp, welcome to the show.
Yeah, happy to be here.
We were just saying off air, we're enjoying your background there. It's sort of like the Geologic Weekend update. Are you familiar with, I think it's Pete Buttigieg had like a geologic map of, anybody familiar with this?
Probably no. Norway. It must have been Norway, right?
I feel like it was Pennsylvania, but now I don't know why it would be Pennsylvania. But who knows? Maybe I'm mistaken.
I use this as the all-purpose, you know, starting point for my you know, mineral prospecting throughout the globe, because we all know that the, you know, this sort of like left Twitter personality business is gonna hit a wall sooner or later. So it's really all about raw minerals. Yeah, mostly copper and, you know, tungsten is what I'm interested in.
We've learned that oil's a safe business this past year, right?
Not exactly.
Now, Matt, we want to talk to you about your piece, this edition of Jacobin. Now, we should just address, how can you as a leftist write for a magazine that would glorify Joe Biden in such a way?
Outrageous. I was appalled. I sent Bosker a strongly worded letter of resignation as soon as I saw that print edition. Totally blindsided, Matt.
Yeah. People don't know Tim Pool was confused by that. Anyway, piece in here, politics of second gilded age. why the Gilded Age? Why do you want to bring that to us?
Quickly on the cover, not to derail things, but yeah. It's funny that everyone, that there was a little brouhaha about that, because I do feel like, and maybe we'll come to this as we move through the conversation, but like in the wake of the stimulus bill, there is a little bit of that tendency that's emerging actually totally unironically. So it's would be interesting to talk about it, but yeah.
Yes. We'll get to that under my section of material versus class politics that I want to get to.
Cool.
Let's go into the elements of the Gilded Age. Why you want to bring that to people?
Yeah, because I mean, as I've said, the there's no more viral decade than the 1880s, and you know, as soon as you drop a historical analogy to the election of 1888, and it's like there's a prospect of Grover Cleveland being involved. People are just like lit. And so basically I'm trying to attract readers with this analogy. No, seriously, it came to me in some ways through, it's not by any means an original comparison in the sense that we've been talking about the second Gilded Age, the new Gilded Age in political economy in terms of, rampant inequality and,
oligarchy.
Exactly. Rampant inequality leading toward political oligarchy in effect with, there are a lot of, and to be honest, as a question of economics, in a lot of ways are the current iteration of capitalism leaves a lot to be desired compared to the sort of heroic productivity of the Gilded Age, of the first Gilded Age, which was really, for all of its incredible violence and brutality, was building a kind of industrial capitalist infrastructure that, of enormous, like lasting, consequence. Whereas I'm not entirely sure what the Silicon, real estate finance industry today is doing what its accomplishments will look like 100 years from now, if they'll be in any way parallel. But okay, leaving that aside, the real meat of the analogy is it's just about the electoral politics. It's about, this was a previous era of politics where you had incredibly high turnout. And that's actually what got me there, as I was, I was looking at the turnout figures this year, which I don't think have necessarily been fully appreciated in all conversations, how high these numbers were. Some of it is about the expansion of voting options because of Corona. But in other ways, you got this pandemic, you might think people would have stayed at home. And it's Biden versus Trump. I mean, on the left, we've been talking about how uninspiring this election was for months and months and months. And in fact, we had enormous turnout. And, something like, almost, high 60% in many states, it was well over 70%, 75%. And that's the Gilded Age looked like was an era in the late 19th century where, you read about the election of say 1888 or 1880, and you don't see huge ideological significance in the debates. They talk about, they talk about material things. They talk about the tariff, talk about currency reform, but ultimately, the two parties are not engaged in any kind of like really transformative project. Neither one. They're serving their constituencies. But that doesn't mean that the fact that there isn't much ideological distance between them doesn't mean that they don't fucking hate each other, because they do. And it doesn't mean that people in the 1880s, that average voters, weren't politicized and polarized and engaged in the process. So you had this was the basis of the analogy. And I know it doesn't work like any historical analogy if you really drill down, but the idea is you have a polarized, motivated, highly organized electorate, engaged in the two-party system, which at the same time is really lacking any kind of serious class component. Mm-hmm. Where there may be, I liked your distinction. I want to hear more about what this class versus politics versus material politics angle is. There may be some elements, there may be economic differences between the party, but there's no real differences in terms of, the balance of power of class forces in the society, because the Republicans in the 1880s, they drew on, voters of a certain ethnocultural profile, regional, based on region, race, ethnic identity, religion, and the Democrats, same thing. And these were the passions that motivated voters. This is what brought people to the polling place. And while there were economic differences between the parties, they the system didn't run on those differences. The system really ran, political scientists and historians, I think, largely agree, if you look at the coalitions, ran on this politics of cultural difference. And I do think that there are parallels to our situation today where, you know, again, the parties aren't identical, but what really motivates voters in these coalitions, it seems to me, is increasingly a kind of partisan identity that is deeply connected to, you know, to culture and you know, race, region, you know, suburban, rural, urban, et cetera. And is really decoupled from the 20th century politics, you know, because I guess I should add that as another counterpoint, the politics of the Long New Deal era, which, you know, in some ways went deep into the even into the 1980s, 1990s, if you look at the coalitions, where there was a certain amount of class alignment, where the Democrats really were the party that, you know, not all the workers voted for, but the party where 70% or even 65% of, you know, of blue collar workers voted Democrat or higher in the New Deal, in the heroic period of the New Deal. And that has really petered out specifically in the last 5-10 years. So I think the consequences are worth pondering. Anyway, that was a long.
Yeah, the high turnout thing is fascinating to me, and I'm curious what your sense of how that happens. How does is what's happening? Is there like a media, especially in the old Gilded Age previously? Like, how were the like serious issues in terms of like labor struggle going on? Was that did that cause the parties to go into these cultural issues? I'm just curious, like how that schism happens between, you know, you're still turning people out, but they're not coming out for real stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, so just to put on the history hat for a minute, I mean, like, this is a party system that emerged in the fires, the cauldron of the Civil War era. You know, that's when the kind of these coalitions were generated in the 1850s before the war, where the Republicans emerged as an anti-slavery party. And, you know, issues of enormous ideological significance were on the ballot. Basically, the future of slavery in, in the world's largest slaveholding republic, which had, you know, massive both material and class consequences, I think. And yet at the same time, drawing on an even older political system, there were cultural there were sort of cultural divergences with those coalitions where, you know, the Whig Party and then the early Republican Party, I think, was defined by the Republican Party is defined by anti-slavery in its initial phase, but it still drew on, largely a sort of Northern Protestant, you know, sort of small farmer, worker and sort of merchant tradesman constituency. And then, you know, so you move through the Civil War era, you move through the Reconstruction era, the Republican Party stays broadly united around anti-slavery, pro-union, pro-Reconstruction politics. And then when that splinters in the 1870s, you know, and now there have been some serious political economic changes. You have, you do have the beginning of the rise of the sort of real industrial capitalism and the rise of the sort of Gilded Age in economics, railroads, factories, et cetera, are getting larger. The Republican Party becomes, you know, becomes something closer to a party of capital as opposed to a party of free labor. And the sort of ideological commitment to Black civil rights and to sort of, you know, the democratic project of Reconstruction diminishes. And then that's the setup into the Gilded Age. But the cultural fracture between the parties that was kind of on the back burner but existed through the 1850s and 60s and 70s becomes more prominent. And that's when, you know, you have Republicans describe the Democrats as the party of, you know, rum, Romanism, and the lash. You know, like, this is what the Democrats stand for: liquor, the Catholic Church, and slavery. And then, you know, going, even leaving Reconstruction behind, the association with the Democrats is this sort of party of the plantation South continues, you know, but it's about a kind of identity politics, as in, you know, you're a party of sort of like backward Southerners and drunks and benighted Catholics. You know, it's not you're a party of plantation oligarchs, which was the Republican critique in the 1850s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you lose the class politics of anti-slavery were always a little ambiguous, and that's another question, but you lost whatever ambiguity was there. It basically almost completely died as, you know, as sort of capital took over the Republican Party. And then on the Democratic side, to the extent that there was, you know, there were stirrings of a sort of a critique of Republicans as the party of big business. I mean, they were also the party of, you know, Southern landowners and the party of, you know, a certain, you know, wing of kind of merchant capital in the North. So there was no, their critique of the Republicans was based on, you know, both on sort of like, you know, government corruption and Yankee prudery. You know, those were the kind of main, you know, hit points, rather than any sort of, you know, sense of the Republicans being a party of, you know, ruling class domination. You know, they both use that rhetoric. Both parties use that rhetoric. Both parties always want to present themselves as the ruling class, as critics of the ruling class in a quasi-democratic society to get votes. But they both had their own robber barons. You know, each party had its own robber barons, you know, just, you know, in a way not too different from today, where you have certain sectors, certain industries that are overwhelmingly all the billionaires are Democrats, you know, in basically tech. And then, you know, in you know, extractive industry, all the billionaires are Republicans.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, one, just how prevalent in American politics, like regionalism is, especially in moments like you're describing, where like that class alignment starts to break down, right? Because you can replace, like, you have people have political energy, even if there aren't serious political material questions, you know, being asked, right? They want to be cheering for their team. And what I like about your piece in particular is, one, the historical analogy, because it does work really well, because we are in a period of time where it is a great time to be an extremely wealthy person in the United States. Like the ability to profit is extreme for those, you know, in the top 10% right now in the society. But what I liked about your piece was that it also tried to pull us away from another analogy that people make a lot, which is the fascism analogy, which is a great way if you don't want to actually have political discussions to, you know, shoot away, right? Because you describe it as a discipline tool, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm looking for, I just saw Corey Robbins said he's got an essay about this coming out, which I really trust him on this question. And I find I you know, a lot of people, you know, some people, a lot of people I respect, you know, it's not an argument that I, you know, it's an argument that I'm willing to have, you know, rather than an argument that, you know, you sort of, you know, want to dismiss. But at the same time, I find the function of that argument, both from liberals and from a certain kind of leftist, you know, who sort of is like to the barricades, actually mm-hmm. obscures the complexity of the real political moment, and is just ultimately just, it's not that it's you know, not that it's like necessarily so politically counterproductive, but it's really unenlightening, I think.
Well, yeah, I just want to say, like, when you turn it, I think it's more interesting when it's a question of elite political activity than when, like, you're talking about when it's let's be concerned about a strain in the population that we need to distrust, basically.
Right. No, exactly. And there are both liberal and left wing variants, if you will, of that version, where it's like, okay, this X percentage of the population, you know, has become functionally fascist, is you know, basically ready to do mass murder against, you know, on an, you know, against you know, large sections of the population. You know, whether I don't, you know, I think for all of the evil in today, and I don't hesitate to use that word, actually, on today's right, I don't think that actually captures the balance of forces or the ideological endpoints of where what these people want. And I think it's a kind of, it ends up being a kind of, yeah, like I said, a Marvel Cinematic Universe version of politics, where, you know, you want to make yourself the hero. I mean, we hated it. We hated it on the left when the neocons just beat the hell out of that metaphor in the war on terror. You know, every unfriendly Islamic government in the Middle East was Islamo-fascist and all this stuff. Mm. And, you know, I don't think it works much better when you do it in domestic politics. It's like, you see the appeal of it, you know, all those neocons who were so fired up about the fascism analogy in the Bush era, a lot of them were, you know, they were former leftists who, and that's partly why they were keen on this idea, is that they had this, you know, when you're lined up, when you can successfully label your enemy as fascist, it gives you a certain kind of juice that is useful to sort of mobilize and organize. But I don't think, you know, if we're trying to do, you know, any kind of sober analysis about the domestic politics of this country, I don't think that that's the situation.
Well, it's like, that's the point that I was trying to make earlier, is like, it evacuates like the actual analysis, right? Because it just becomes a moral imperative that like something must be done, right? I want to move a little bit in this direction to sort of talk about our present moment though, because, you know, there is a lot of analysis that needs to be done, and we're starting to enter in a time where we can actually start to look at a little bit, you know, the data and who turned out and voted for Biden a little bit closer. Could you explain what the Stacey Abrams thesis is and why that thesis is generally wrong?
The Stacey Abrams will save us thesis. I mean, there's a certain element, to be honest. I think even the most thoughtful, you know, even the most thoughtful liberals and Democratic Party folks at this point have abandoned it. But I think in the immediate aftermath, especially of the Senate race, there was some energy that wanted to basically be like, yeah, the Democrats won by basically turning out Black working class voters. And that's really the only group in the coalition that counts and that mattered, and that provided the difference on the margins. But if you look at, you know, even in Georgia, where the evidence for that argument is strongest, because there were increases in, you know, in Black turnout, as there were increases in statewide turnout in virtually every group. If you really drill into the sort of the precinct level data, you know, for the presidential election, and you compare it to 4 years ago, 8 years ago, you see that there were some increases in Black turnout in some places. Other places, you know, especially, you know, poor and working class areas in Atlanta, you didn't really see much turnout increase, or you saw either flat or sometimes declines. But you saw massive, massive overwhelming. And, you know, whether you look at it at the precinct level or whether you look at it, you know, using, you know, more advanced statistical methods, you know, it's wealthy, suburban, overwhelmingly white, a little bit Asian areas that swung hard from Republican to Biden. And this is, you know, the idea that, like, you know, Stacey Abrams did make a difference, because Stacey Abrams converted a lot of those voters. You know, they like Stacey Abrams. So it's not, I don't want to make it seem like Stacey Abrams can only speak to sort of Black voters, you know, so I don't want to say that Stacey Abrams didn't do her job. You know, her job was to turn Georgia blue, and she did it. So she should get credit. But there is in the national media, there is a kind of, you know, there's an interesting kind of, I don't know, I forget whether it's a metonymy or a synecdoche or whatever, where you look at Stacey, you put Stacey Abrams as the face of the party, and you're like, okay, this is all about Black voters then. Right. And right. Black voters obviously are at the core of the Democratic coalition in terms of, you know, their numbers, you know, the rate at which they vote Democrat. But they're not the reason why Georgia flipped. The huge difference was these suburbanites who have become the kind of, the key to the balance of power in a lot of places by turning from red to blue. And, you know, I just think at minimum we should acknowledge, and I do think increasingly, and maybe we'll get to this, increasingly people do acknowledge that. They just start saying that's a good thing, but they're starting to acknowledge it.
Yeah, I mean, the cost with winning the Joe Biden way, like, I was never one of these leftists that said, oh, Biden is turning his back on the left, now he's definitely going to lose. It's like, we need to the conclusion or like ramifications of what if he wins. And you you talk about some of these referendum, I think it was the fair tax in Chicago. Clue us in on that.
Yeah, because I mean, this is the second part of the argument. So it's like, first of all, we need to acknowledge that it's like the working class is more divided than ever. To some extent, you know, you can look at one race in Georgia and say, okay, Black voters did come out a little bit more. Still, it was overwhelmingly driven by suburbanites. And then if you look nationally, unquestionably, working class voters trended Republican, white, Latino, to some extent, even Black voters, which is remarkable. And that is to me worrying if you're interested in, you know, building up working class power within the Democratic Party in any sense. So, the second question is, okay, this is happening. What are the implications of it? And yeah, my some people will tell you, and they'll talk about, there was an argument in Vox just, it came out this week. You know, I think a lot of the Vox and New York Mag types have been queuing my piece up to dunk on it in light of the stimulus, because it's kind of like, oh, Matt Carp says there are no differences between Republicans and Democrats. Hey, look, the Republicans do tax cuts. The Democrats do, you know, massive redistribution via the budget. And we'll talk about what the budget does or what that stimulus bill does or doesn't do in a minute. But I think the new argument is, yeah, these middle class, these upper middle class voters, they're delivering, they're progressive. They're, you know, polls show that they support progressive causes, including and economics. So let's ride or die with Biden, and we will get everything we could get rather than trying to like go to that Donald Trump diner one more damn time and try to get that MAGA hat guy to sort of, you know, just murmuring single payer healthcare to him. It's not going to work. He's on the right now. And that's more or less the case. But Matt, what you're talking about is I looked in the piece at a number of, you know, how does the new Democratic politics work at the state level? That's one place to look into sort of the, you know, states as laboratories of democracy. And, you know, these places where Democrats really control the politics, how are these new coalitions voting to slice up the pie? And in Illinois, you have a billionaire governor who was elected by this same kind of Biden coalition that, you know, has taken over the Democratic Party, J.B. Pritzker, who's, you know, hardly a, you know, a figure of, you know, great stature on the labor left. Mm-hmm. But he looked at Illinois' budget, which is a disaster, and said, okay, we need a progressive tax on the very wealthy to keep this budget alive. And this can only be done via referendum. And the new Democratic coalition did not deliver. You know, the Republicans voted against it, including working class Republicans, because, you know, people don't vote their class anymore, and that's bad. And so you have, you know, people in downstate Illinois and rural Illinois who, you know, voted for Barack Obama, voted for Bill Clinton, who voted for Democrats all through the New Deal, and now vote Republican, and so are economically right wing because they identify all this stuff as like, the Democrats want this, so I don't want this. But more disturbingly, the new Democratic coalition voted for Biden overwhelmingly, and then so many people split their ballots in the Tony precincts of Chicago, in the fancy burbs where, you know, I talk about where the Home Alone house is, you know, the $1.5 million house where Kevin McAllister, you know, was left alone. You know, all those places voted, you know, overwhelmingly blue and against this progressive tax. So it's kind of like, what can this coalition get you? It can get Democrats in office. Can it redistribute wealth?
And this is like, I really want to focus, especially in the last bit, on this question of class de-alignment, because I think that's like one of my favorite parts of your piece and one of the most important arguments that we need to be, you know, dealing with on the left. Because as you know, like in Georgia, we saw what ended up, you know, winning the day for Biden, or at least was flipped the state, were these wealthier folks. In, you know, my home state of Texas, you see this similar trend too, right? Where like older, you know, suburban voters, more traditional suburban voters were starting to vote blue while the Democrats lost, you know, votes in communities like Latin communities and Black communities where they thought that they were never under threat. And it's this BS Democratic Party strategy that they think that they're just going to get all those votes for granted, right? And those people are always going to show up for them. And then that that you make this great point in your piece that this is what a victory looks like with this coalition, right? Is that Biden becoming president, but not really having a majority to be able to implement his policies.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. I mean, they've managed to do okay so far, but we're about to find out what they can really, mm-hmm. what they can really do. But yeah, I mean, you know, this class de-alignment where, I mean, there are a couple reasons to be concerned about it. And, you know, my concern as a socialist, as somebody who believes in class politics at the center of my understanding of how, you know, the political system works, is that, you know, if you're relying on, you know, suburbanites who make $200,000 a year to sort of achieve progressive politics, you might get, you know, a few crumbs on the table, but you're not going to get social democracy. You're not going to get, you know, let alone anything more that we want. Yeah, you're going to get, you're in fact, not only are you not going to get it, you're going to have a, you have a, this is the Gilded Age part. You have a situation where all the forces of the political system are actually stonewalled and locked, work to stonewall and lock out this very politics that we thought under Bernie, et cetera, was starting to finally get a little daylight. Mm-hmm. And if you have the Joe Biden coalition in charge of the Democratic Party, there are hard limits on what that can achieve, and it's gonna go in a different direction. They're not gonna set up single payer healthcare, which does involve serious taxes on the upper middle class. You know, if they can't do it to sort of save schools and pensions in Illinois or California, why would they do it to sort of reprogram the whole health system? Like, that's just not going to happen with this coalition, is my view. And then the other fear, this is also to your point, David, that some people, that even people who aren't socialists worry about, is that this is a very narrow coalition. You know, this is a coalition that just doesn't have the numbers right now. Mm-hmm. And you need more working class voters, even than Biden got, to basically retake state houses, to retake the Senate, to actually even do whatever it is that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer want to do. Mm-hmm. Even to actually do that kind of, kind of moderate liberalism, you don't have the votes to do that, because, you know, you're concentrated in cities, you're concentrated in wealthy suburbs, less than a third of people in America have college degrees, and that's not going to be enough to actually, if you continue to bleed working class votes.
And because the reason this question is, I mean, there's a million reasons this question is important, but like, it's really important for socialists to wrestle with this like class dealignment that we're seeing, because I think especially people who are sort of, you know, when you first start to become a socialist, you think that like kind of like class consciousness or class politics are just going to happen like spontaneously, right? And we are living through the proof that that is just not the case. We are living through a society that is more unequal than it's probably ever been before. I'm not a historian, so I got a little timid there, but like, you know, an extremely unequal, society.
Go for it, David.
You know, a horrible pandemic. And very clearly, like, even though, yeah, we are seeing some movement from Biden, they're trying to address it on some level, but certainly nowhere near what needs to be done. That is not, and even all these people show up to vote, as, you know, you're saying in this most recent election, that we aren't just seeing, you know, this massive wave of like working class politics, right? That like, and I'm sorry to go on a rant here, but it's like, you know, this is basic like Marxism 101. This is Communist Manifesto. You know, Marx says like the first goal of the communists is to organize the proletariat into a class, right? And like, we need to understand as socialists that organization, that organizing work, is going to be really critical if we want to see any escape from, you know, the current situation, because it's just not going to happen spontaneously.
Yeah. And, you know, I would just add to that, I mean, to even thrust the knife even a little deeper into my own breast here, you know, it can't organize itself on the basis of one heroic presidential campaign. Yeah. I mean, we've learned that now, and nobody was a bigger, was more attached to the collar of Saint Bernard than I was. But I think, you know, and he achieved a lot. I wrote about this previously, you know, I think he's moved the needle in 100 ways that are going to last. So I'm not reaching down into despair here. But the premise of both Bernie runs, to the extent that, you know, they were actual bids to do working class politics through a presidential primary, was basically, you know, if you speak it, they will come. Mm-hmm. If you say in single payer healthcare, if you say, you know, free college, if you say $15 minimum wage, and then you name the enemy, you say the billionaires won't let you have this, I want to give this to you, that the working class will more or less hear that message, which has been left out of scrupulously, you know, kind of, you know, sort of marginalized from politics. If you just say it loud enough, then, you know, from the hills of West Virginia to the plains of Kansas, people will rise. And, you know, they did to an extent. You know, we had tens of millions of people voted for Bernie that when he was laughed off the stage when he started to vote. So I'm not shitting on Bernie, but they did not rise in the numbers that we needed to sort of initiate a working class revolution in this country. So, so what the point is, yeah, we need organization, and it can't just happen from sort of through electoral politics alone. That's my big takeaway. And it can't happen overnight. It's going to be a long haul here, and politics can make a difference. But it can't do it by itself.
You mentioned the Vox set getting ready to dunk on you over the COVID relief bill. So let's talk about that. That's where I guess the material versus class politics. It looks like the Democrats, while not the full $2,000, for instance, are starting to learn how to put money out the door into people's pockets a little bit. It's like post-Reagan or Keynes of the 21st century. I see people talk about. How does this fit into your thesis, and what do you think it signifies? And I want to also say, just to add on to this, like, I'm hearing a lot of, frankly, more optimistic talk about the PRO Act than I thought I would have. And that, I think, would change things a little bit if Biden can get PRO Act done. But let's just keep this to the COVID bill for now, maybe.
Okay, I'll do COVID first. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of good things in that bill, and I don't think that we, as the sectarian leftists that we are very well served by, you know, denying that the sky is blue, that, you know, that this is a big difference from the Obama stimulus, for instance, and as liberals have been trumpeting, you know, for two reasons. One, it's, you know, almost twice as large in GDP terms. Two, it was done without any bipartisan compromise, really, of any kind. We talk about the minimum wage, but they didn't cut the package in order to sort of please the moderates. They did what they said they were going to do in terms of the total number, and the number is huge. And so I think, yeah, I agree that, you know, what is it? The guy on Twitter, James Medlock, said, you know, the era of big government is over. I think that's right. I think we're entering a new period. And so the kind of standard jibes about neoliberal austerity and, you know, watch Biden come in there and he's just going to be like, oh, the deficit, bye bye Social Security. Like, we hit him on that during the campaign, but that's not accurate as a portrait of where the Democratic Party is now. There's a new era of what I'm calling. I did write a thing for Jacobin. Hopefully it'll come out tomorrow. Budgetary liberalism, I think, is what I was saying. You know, it's a throwback to a certain kind of Keynesian view of macroeconomics that, you know, for one, that, you know, that the entire economy, including lots of businesses who supported this act, like, you know, Google, Goldman Sachs, you know, Zillow, they were all in favor of this act, that this really will juice the economy in a way that, you know, austerity won't. Some of it is the macroeconomics. Some of it is genuinely kind of, to some extent, redistributive in intent. Like, I would compare it to a weaker version of the Great Society in the 60s, where it's like, okay, we can't help the poor. There are real anti-poverty programs in this stimulus. So that's all real. But there are two things that we need to remember as context. First of all, this is not just about, like, the Democratic Party is now a social democratic party or something. This is on the heels of an even larger stimulus package that the Republicans did just this same damn year that didn't make anybody think that Donald Trump sent everyone, you know, $1,800 worth of checks. No one thinks that he's a social democrat. You know, the Republicans spent $3 trillion. You know, that's, they've done more stimulus and they've done more checks than Biden has. So no one thinks that they're socialists. This is about a broader shift in how both parties really, the Republican Party is not a party of small government anymore. It never really was, but it's not even a party of small government ideology anymore. There's no Tea Party happening under Trump. They're complaining about Dr. Seuss. They're not on the warpath. They're already starting to take credit for the stimulus. They voted against it, but they don't hate it. There's no grassroots opposition. Polls show Republicans like this stimulus. So look, that's a good thing. It's a good thing that we're not in a, you know, tight-fisted punishing austerity mode, that neither party is in that mode. And in some weird, ironic way, maybe we have class de-alignment to thank for that, because the Republicans have all these working class voters who are like, yeah, I want my check. And in that sense, both parties agree, let the faucet flow. So that being said, there might be some sort of minimal gains on that. But look, yeah, like Matt, as you said, is there anything in this bill that changes the balance of class forces? Is there anything that actually empowers working people as opposed to just giving them a little relief? No, you know, none of the structural things, nothing in this bill is structural. We'll see if they make the child allowance permanent. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. Nothing obligates them to. They rejected the minimum wage. That was the one structural thing in the bill that they dinged. Not just Joe Manchin, but both senators from the Republic of Biden dinged it. You know, clearly there was no pressure on the Democrats to fight for that wage amendment. They're not, I don't expect them to pick up that lance again in this session. So, you know, there, and this is where my, I still think, you know, my class D alignment thesis is still undefeated, because I'm prepared to acknowledge that they're going to do that. They can grow the budget on deficit finance right now, that we're in a Keynesian moment as opposed to a tight-fisted monetarian moment. That's fine. That doesn't really entail a deep politics of redistribution, structural change, or, you know, class political empowerment. If to get to the second part of the question, if they do the PRO Act, then I'll eat some crow. You know, if they do the PRO Act, that would make a difference. And that would say, okay, that actually would get the ball running for the kind of organization that we need. So I it doesn't mean that they're social Democrats, but it would really surprise me if they get the PRO Act in.
Right. Well, Matt Karp, check out the piece we talked about in this edition that glorifies Joe Biden and Jacobin, and his Budgetary Democrats piece come out in the next edition. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Sorry for the run-ons here.
Oh, no, really. It's a good time, man.
See you, Matt. All right. Peace. I'll go back looking for some minerals.
Oh, that was good.
Yeah, we can just keep it rolling if we want.
Yeah, we're on.
We are still on, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, I just like, I thought that piece was really great, and people should definitely spend the time with it because, you know, we talked about a lot of different things in that interview because there was a lot of different arguments in that piece, the historical one, the
Michigan
kind of vote
analysis.
Michigan
we didn't even talk about. There's a lot we didn't even get to, yeah.
I know.
Big old piece.
But I think it's really important, and I'm just going to repeat it again. That socialists, like, you have to understand that, you know, like, Marxists and socialists believe that the working class has the potential to change the society for the better, but it's not a given. It's something, it's a potential that has to be built. And it's something that a lot, especially people who, it's just something that people really need to reckon with on the socialist left, that these things aren't just going to happen. You know, we can bring in a lot of people with good messaging and putting ideas out there and inspiring hope. But until we start to build those vehicles that do that real political education work, we're going to be in a difficult place because the hope of, well, like, just even think about like a union, right? Like, the reason a union has power is because you have all of these different people from, you know, different communities, potentially wherever, who go into work. And then they recognize through the process of organizing that they have a lot more in common with the person sitting next to them than they do with the person at the office at the front of the shop, right? And then through that consciousness, they build an organization that then fights for their interests. It's the same exact question in politics, right? And it's not something that is just going to happen spontaneously. It's something that is a conscious movement that we all need to be building with other members of the working class to be able to implement our kind of politics, right? And I think that's where you get a lot of fuzzy analysis from people, certainly from liberals on this question of like, what does the working class actually want? But even from socialists too, when they forget that, you know, a fundamental part of politics, of socialist politics, is building that class consciousness to make the working class recognize itself as a worker instead of, you know, whatever. We all have many different identities and things that we enjoy and things that we think of ourselves as, right? And what we have to do is to build that consciousness that, you know, the working class, that you're a member of the working class, and that you need to stand with, you know, other members of the working class to change the society.
And this is why people should follow up on David's suggestion on the work of Sam Gindin and Leo Panish.
Yeah.
I was just reading that memorial in Jacobin,
which so is sweet.
One of the longer things I've read in Jacobin, but yeah, I mean, very good. And those guys, they thought through all these questions. And interesting, I mean, I'm just now starting to get an appreciation of Ralph Miliband's place in sort of Marxist theory beyond just a quirk that he wrote and was the dad of a politician. And that he was like one of the first guys to actually think through this too, which is very interesting.
Yeah. And just like, as like one quick notice, like exactly like going into the work of like Panish and getting in Miliband and Polansis and Marx and Lenin, like spending time, you know, wrestling with these questions is important, not just as like an academic exercise, but because we have very serious questions to deal with in the present moment, because we are seeing a trend go one way, and whatever the hell the Democrats are trying to build right now, if it's viable is, you know, one question, but if it's, if it is successful, it would be extremely damaging, as Matt was saying earlier. If they can do this kind of suburban realignment and completely ditch the working class as like they're like, they didn't listen to the working class as like, you know, they definitely weren't the bosses of the Democratic Party, but they at least had to like, you know, try to throw them some red meat, if even just symbolic from time to time. If they can do the suburban stuff, they will, because they're much happier to represent people who make $150,000 a year, who aren't trying to ask for real structural change to the society, rather than just, you know, kind of management and tweaking.
Yeah, I mean, the thing we could have stressed more with Matt, but we want to kind of move forward, is like this isn't a natural voting pattern. This is very much cultivated Democratic Party strategy going back to like the 80s. This is who they wanted to win with. And yeah, that's, I think, the most crucial, because they'll want a natural, which is the reactionary function that democracy can serve to elites, which is like, if they can get a result that points to something they want, then this is what the people want. Really depressing stuff, because I forget what those terminology is, but those, I remember reading something in the 80s that was like, yeah, we're basically going to go over, this is the PMC stuff, but like the Democrats, very like, unions are going away, we're going to need to go for professionals. And that's the other thing, is like, that's a recipe for electoral losses. Sure. That's not the main, like, they can also win that way though. And also, and freeze you out of politics. So it's, yeah, I don't know. It's,
well, that's the thing, is like, you know, we have this great like historical advantage as socialists, because we do have this like, you know, class ready, you know, in wait, right? If you build it, you know, we have the majorities, but we have to build that consciousness. But to build that, like, we have to deliver, and we have to do the kind of organizing for like people in the Democratic Party, like the leadership. They don't have to deliver anything other than wins, right? And fundraising, which means that their calculus can be very different from ours, because they don't have the responsibility on the other side to do a lot, right? You know, we want nothing short of fundamentally changing, you know, the state of work and people's like social relations with one another. So we have a tall task to meet, and also like a responsibility that comes with that, you know, to organize politically in a very different way. I don't know. It's just like, you know, so like they can play the suburban game, the Democratic Party can. And I think that there's some serious limits to that strategy. But again, we saw, you know, it eke out something. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're able to, you know, continue this trend of winning over, you know, the $150,000 a year set in this country, especially with one of the most important things, and we didn't even get to really get to this with Matt, one of the most critical things in this country is that we're not necessarily even seeing so much of a shift of like the working class to voting like Republican. What we're seeing more than anything is just the working class is not participating in politics at all, which is an extremely damaging and dangerous situation. Yeah. So big questions, you know, and it's just like, we got to think constructively about them and understand that, you know, class formation is a process, and it's a conscious one, and it's not something that it's just, I'm sorry, y'all. I mean, we like, I'm not like, sometimes people misunderstand when I say these like criticisms of like Syriza or like Bernie or hell, even what happened in labor. It's not being down. I supported these movements, but like, we're now in 2021 and trying to understand, okay, what were the actual limitations to them? Doesn't mean that you don't try. Like, you try with Bernie Sanders. Like, we look, and when Bernie Sanders ran, we didn't have the class organization that we needed to make that happen, right? But that doesn't mean you don't go for it, right? It was like our best, you know, it was our best shot. We're going to have to continue to make those decisions to do that in the future. But it also would be great if when Bernie Sanders announced that he was running for 2016, that we had 5-6 years of serious working class organization and mobilization to prepare us for that moment, instead of trying to build that up in the short, you know, term of campaign. These are why these questions are really important for us to start dealing with.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I'll go ahead.
Oh, no.
I was just going to say, like, with regards to the COVID relief bill, like, I'm glad that more money is going out the door. But it is, and as far as the child poverty stuff, which, like Matt mm-hmm. said, they should definitely extend forever. And yeah. Biden can fully do that, my understanding is, in a future reconciliation bill. But there is an element of, particularly when you pull back from the minimum wage increase, where it is like landlords for UBI. Like,
yeah. Of course. I mean, how could they not do this bill? Like, right. That's the thing. It's like, yeah, as Matt was saying, and Matt's saying, like, they have to do this. Like, they're really like, it's like economic suicide to let people languish like they are. If you want the system to function, you have to, I mean, look, like Milton Friedman, you know, had the concept of helicopter money, right? This is like an arts capitalist who said, you know, every once in, for people who aren't familiar, like he had this idea that like every once in a while, you just need to like throw money out into the public. I mean, he's tongue in cheek, obviously, but like the idea was like, there has to be redistribution, mm-hmm. At some point to keep this system, you know, functioning. And that's somebody who believes, you know, deeply, in the efficiency and righteousness of capitalism, saying that, right? So of course the people who, maintain the system know that they have to do stimulus from time to time.
Yeah, it's like with healthcare now, the provisions to just cover COVID payments is the ultimate example of material politics over class politics, because it's going to cost way more fucking money to just subsidize these COBRA plans with the private insurance than it would to just give everybody Medicare for all.
Yeah.
But they want to maintain that rentier structure and the fucking, you know, privatized whatever so people can profit off it. So we're going to go with, and I mean, that fundamentally that also brings up what we talk about ad nauseum with, what's it called? The infinite money spending.
MMT.
MMT stuff, right? It's like, yeah. It's like MMT, okay, we have infinite amount of money to just subsidize COBRA. Like, yeah. Right? Like, that's fundamentally the problem here. So I think, you know, I would love the COBRA Act. I'd love Matt to feel that hot water.
The PRO Act?
If they pass the PRO Act. But I ultimately think the dynamic that he's zeroed in on is fundamentally the one that everyone should have their eye on.
You know, and it's just like, look, the PRO Act, again, like that's something that if that passes, that's massive. And I think it's important, for example, that organizations like the DSA and other left-wing organizations and unions are pushing as much as possible, because you have to fight for it and we want it to happen. I have serious doubts.
It'd be a union victory, if not Biden.
It'd be a huge victory. But like, you know, what we saw even with that stimulus was the Democrats were negotiating against themselves, right? And that's the reality that we're getting from you know, the Biden and Harris administration, is that, you know, they'll do what is necessary on like the bare minimum scale of like passing, you know, basic stimulus that any functioning society should be able to pass, frankly.
Right. Well, especially the one with as much wealth.
As no. Yeah. you know, so, you know, so we're seeing what we're going to get from this coalition, and you know, we have to start really doing the work of figuring out how we're going to beat it. But I think we should let's do some more Lula, because I need a little bit of inspiration. We have some clips, and we can get into a little bit more. Again, we're going to do a really next week episode is going to be dedicated to that. You know, if you sort of scroll forward a little bit, Matt, to like when he actually gives a speech. I think that would be great. Around, you'll find it. But you know, again, like Lula has had these charges dropped. As I was hinting at earlier, you know, there are some questions about the political calculus of Judge Fachin in pulling back these charges against Lula, that it might be, you know, to protect people like Moro. But again, it is a reality of like the political calculus changing, because so many people were organizing and fighting against this. Lula is certainly fired up, and we'll talk a little bit about the speech that he made after we watched this clip. But I just wanted to put this clip on, one, to celebrate a little bit, and just to remember what this felt like when things seemed so dark in Brazil with the rise of Bolsonaro and Lula turning himself in. So this is the day before Lula surrendered himself to be imprisoned for crimes that he did not commit, in a extremely ridiculous, you know, trial against him that was fueled by the United States, the FBI, and the CIA. And that's not just me alleging it at this point. We have material evidence of that. In fact, way more material evidence than they were ever able to.
Yeah, funny you should mention material evidence.
But anyways, we should play this because it's a really great, great speech that Lula gives here.
Não adianta tentar evitar que eu ande por esse país, porque tem milhões e milhões de Lula, de Bolo, de Manuela, de Dilma Rousseff para andar por mim. Não adianta tentar acabar, sabe, com as minhas ideias. Elas já estão pairando no ar e não tem como prendê-las. Não adianta tentar parar o meu sonho, porque quando eu parar de sonhar, eu sonharei pela cabeça de vocês e pelo dono de vocês. Não adianta achar que tudo vai parar o dia que o Lula tiver infarto. É bobagem, porque o meu coração baterá pelo coração de vocês e são milhões de corações. Os poderosos podem matar uma, duas ou três rosas, mas jamais conseguirão deter a chegada da primavera. E a nossa luta é em busca da primavera.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's just something else. It brings a little bit of chills, obviously, for us personally too. It was, you know, that, that fight was so important to the work that we had been doing. And I think we'll spend a little bit of time in the post game, maybe watching Michael's interview with Lula, because that was a really special moment. But one thing that I think is very interesting about like the Lula that we're seeing now is that he is very much fired up. I think it's seemingly very clear that he is going to run in 2022. And one thing that Michael had said to me a couple of times privately was that, you know, Lula had been able to spend so much time when he was in prison, like reading and theorizing, because he wasn't so, he didn't have to be so engaged, like on the streets and stuff like that, that he was sort of coming out with not just like a lot of, you know, like physical energy, frankly, but also like a very strong theoretical and political energy, which I'm really excited to see how that, that develops.
Yeah, it's interesting. So far, I mean, we talked about his speech. He emphasized Bolsonaro's catastrophic handling of COVID. It will be, and a lot of the analysts I saw say he's striking a moderate tone. And it's interesting in, you know, watching The Edge of Democracy, there's a, and we'll watch some clips of that in the post game. But there's a whole group of people that are yelling, saying, and they're not like left or right. They're saying no parties, like get out of our face, like about any kind of party because of the amount of polarization that has gone on in Brazil. And I think like it's interesting strategically how Bolsonaro is, because there's also who knows if there's going to be more lawfare. Hopefully not. Hopefully like Moro is like the end of it. I don't know. I'm glad to hear that part of it. I hadn't heard that, his sort of theoretical time.
But I mean, even the way that his interviews, you know, when he was let out, like he started to become a lot more pugnacious with talking about U.S. involvement. You know, one of the first things he did recently, earlier this week, was, you know, thank you know, Maduro for his support and proclaim that he, you know, stands fervently against United States involvement in Venezuela, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Cuba, right? He's very much aligning himself with the global left movements, right? And I think it's an important thing. Not that Lula wasn't aware of the great danger to the North, but then, you know, he tried to have like a conciliatory relationship with like global finance and global capital. They really thought that they were going to, you know, if they didn't push too hard, you know, and completely shift the economy into like a full on, you know, socialist, you know, vision, that they would be able to implement the really critical reforms that were needed in Brazil. And what we've seen now after, you know, seeing the end of Lava Jato and the lawfare against Lula is that even that kind of very, very conciliatory approach, the United States will still work against you and treat you as a threat. And you know, and that's structural. I will also say that there is a personal thing. And it's another thing that Mike would always mention, that Obama was extremely jealous of Lula. You know, when he calls him the most popular politician in the world, I don't think that was all coming from admiration as much as a little bit of anger that he wasn't the one who was considered to be that globally.
Also, like, you compare like what they were doing like decades ago, and Lula is way more, like, Obama, Harvard Law. I mean, good luck. No. Lula's in the streets with, you know, up against dictatorship. That's the other thing about, you know, the end of democracy as a title is, you realize, like, how recent that is in a lot of places. I mean, people should realize that we're barely even in America too, but like literally military rule of the country. And you have people that go into the streets saying, bring the generals, where are you? Come back. Because like that, it's like a third party. The third party in Brazil is the generals come back and fix everything.
Yeah, you know, exactly. And again, next week, we're going to do a really in-depth interview with Victor, you know, who was formerly at The Intercept, and they did such an incredible job of exposing the fraud that was Lava Jato. Also, of course, want to shout out Brian Muir and Brazil Wire. And there's a couple of last points I wanted to make before we move on from this. One, I wanted to read this section from Brian Muir's piece in Brazil Wire. Let me see, I can pass it over to you just if you wanted to show it. Just the title for everybody. Oh, it's probably not going to work. But it's a piece in Brazil Wire called Lava Jato Dies, Lula is Reborn, Behind the Supreme Court Ruling, where Brian Muir just does a great job recapping, you know, what's happened over the past few years. And this is a section from it that I think, you know, really hits home. After all, none of the charges against Lula had any material evidence. They were all based on coerced plea bargain testimonies by jailed businessmen who, in every case, changed their stories multiple times before receiving partial illicit asset retention, greatly reduced sentences, and transfer to house arrest. In the triplex apartment case, Moro was forced to sentence Lula for indeterminate acts of corruption. Let me read that again to y'all. Moro was forced to sentence Lula for indeterminate acts of corruption because no material evidence was ever produced showing that Lula owned or slept in the apartment or that the alleged illegal reforms had taken place. Furthermore, prosecutors were unable to establish any quid pro quo because the alleged benefits took place years after Lula had left office. And I just want people to remember how ridiculous these charges were. And for folks who aren't familiar, because, you know, you hear Lava Jato and it's the corruption, the only thing that they were able to like try to pin on him, and they weren't able to prove it at all, was this theory that maybe Lula got some bathroom renovations on an apartment for cheap. Right. Still paid for them, but just like for like, you know, significantly less, as, you know, a kind of bribe to him. Again, no actual evidence of this, no real connection, but that's as close as they got to anything against Lula. Of course, it was nonsensical. It was a part of their strategy to just throw anything against him and hope that there would be enough media frenzy that they would be able to either prevent him from running a successful campaign, or what they ended up being successful with was prevent him from actually running for office at all. I bring this up because we talked a lot about Lula over these past few years for a couple of different reasons. One, because he's a very important figure on the global left and because of, you know, his political strategy and what he has done for Brazil, right? And we'll talk a little bit more about that next week. But it also really highlights something that was critical to the work of TMBS, which was trying to encourage us to think politically and strategically and materially about politics, and not to get distracted by symbolism or abstractions, right? What do I mean by that? The symbolism against Lula was anti-corruption politics, right? And it was just like what we were talking about with Matt Karp earlier in this episode, where like you start to say like, oh, this is a campaign against corruption. And like everyone's brains start to turn off, right? Because they're like, oh, well, corruption is bad. Oh, and this is going through the court. So those must be neutral arbiters of this question, right? And they were successful in this because so many people, one, were willing in Brazil. The ruling class hated Lula. As you know, Lula said that one time that, you know, they hated him so much because he had, somebody told him once that they hated him because he turned the airports into a bus station. Basically what he means, you know, what he means by that is that because people's standards of living increased, that they did not want to be seeing other members of their country in these, you know, elitist areas, right?
I mean, that's, like, I think that example is so important because I think that is in the wild and sort of pre-partisan, the counter-revolutionary sort of sentiment in people. And like to the extent that people have that sort of reaction, they're an enemy until they remedy it, basically.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. And yeah, it's exactly what you're saying there. And like, so, you know, that was like a big part of the motivation for his opponents. And honestly, we should talk more about what happened in the United States and in the United Kingdom, where you had all of these idiots take that bait, hook, line, and sinker, right? Where they started to say, oh, wow, you know, I want a Lava Jato t-shirt, right? Like they thought that these like anti-corruption politics were legitimate when they clearly weren't. And all you need to do was to start to look at the class forces and do that kind of serious analysis to see that something was up there. Right. So, you know, remember that, understand that this trial, just like any kind of major political event, these things are never going to be neutral. And you need to just erase that concept from your head if you want to do serious political analysis. Right. All of these decisions have a motivation behind them. Right. As to what is possible under the current conditions. The conditions then allowed them to imprison Lula. The conditions now do not. Right? It's the same law, right? It's the same, you know, judges, the same figures. They're changing the ruling now because they have changed political calculus. And you need to understand this because that is how they play you. Lava Jato was designed to tank Lula because the right wing knew they couldn't beat him. They didn't intend for Bolsonaro to come into the chaos, but they were happy with him to be the sledgehammer to destroy the project of Lula da Silva and the Workers' Party. Right. So this is a victory for Brazil and for poor and working people. But you need to understand that this is not limited to Brazil. Right. It's, you know, they understand that if they can turn politics away from actual class analysis and material policy analysis, things like that, into these kind of like notions of like impartiality and like neutrality, that they can achieve a lot. What do I mean by that? In Brazil, it was the accusations of corruption against Lula and Lawfare, right? In Bolivia, it was the same thing when they said that Evo Morales was tampering with the votes, right? And a lot of the same people who were condemning Lula were very quick to accept completely fraudulent accusations about Evo Morales that led to a right-wing coup against him, right? The stakes are high. Don't be sloppy. Don't let these people get away with it. We're seeing another chapter of this right now with what the seemingly character who has grown in some kind of like progressive, like lab grown area to appeal to like American, you know, left wingers. I'm talking about Yaku Perez, and we'll get to him in the post game too. And I've got to say this again, you know, who is now somebody, you know, all these people in the United States were, you know, going on about like, oh, wow, this is so great. We have like this eco-socialist who's running, and it's like, oh, wow, what an incredible moment. You have the traditional left versus like this kind of new, more granola left, right? And it stunk to high heaven then. And now we're seeing very clearly what his end game is, which is to delegitimize a legitimate election in Ecuador. He's now calling for the military and the police to take action against the fraudulent election in Ecuador. Again, no credible evidence of any kind of fraud.
Is he saying anything about Jovenel Moise? I mean, not that he, I guess he could be expected to, but, you know, just to talk about that double standard, you know, if it was like a Maduro term gets an extension, gets viewed a lot differently by, for instance, the OAS than Jovenel Moise, it's like, all right, let's just roll with Moise for whatever. There's some... Yeah. There's some problems, but he's cool with the IMF, so, you know, let's roll with them.
No, I mean, and like, you know, remember Perez was somebody who celebrated Evo Morales's ouster. He was somebody who celebrated Lula's imprisonment, right?
Which, we, I mean, all, you know, how is, yeah, it's just, it, that, to me, like, that's a good enough, that's enough.
Yeah, for sure. It's enough evidence there, but it's just like, just don't be sloppy because they know how to play you, right? And anyways, I'll end up, you know, on that note, but just like, no, the FBI and the CIA were involved in Lava Jato. They know how to play to an international audience. They know how to tell these stories and they know what works. Be very, you know, be serious, be structural in your analysis. Don't let yourself get caught up in these, you know, cinematic narratives, because they certainly are written. If that is the case, right? If it just seems so like, oh, wow, this is like a movie, you know, all the big bad guys are going down because that we finally have good justice system in Brazil. And, you know, they're going to take them down and, you know, the corrupt guys are going to go away and there's going to be peace and prosperity.
And then the system can actually get back to, you know, delivering for the people.
Yeah, like it did before Lula was in power, right? I don't know. It's just like, be serious, be prepared for this, because they know that they try this playbook everywhere. And it's just like, it's very important to be, you know, not suspicious, not conspiratorial about anything, but to sit here and say, huh, I wonder who would want to take Lula out. I wonder, you know, what kind of like class interest there are in destroying one of the most popular left-wing candidates in the globe on charges that he got some construction work done on an apartment in a beach town, but is also not even one of the most popular beach towns in Brazil, right? Like, you should sit there and say to yourself, like, okay, something's a little bit fishy here, instead of just sprinting you know, support of these things. And if you don't know, spend a little bit of time in research before you shoot your mouth off, especially if you're a journalist, I will say. That was the thing that, like, the Guardian completely debased itself, you know, when it came to, you know, to Lava Jato.
I mean, the Guardian, I remember in like high school, college, that was like the left wing paper I would check on. You know, I was like too, I guess, snooty for HuffPo. So I learned to go to the Guardian, and on a number of issues, from that to, you know, the Corbyn stuff, you know, what's going on? What's going on at the Manchester Guardian?
Yeah, man.
The history behind that paper.
I just want to, as a like a little bow on this, I want to just read from Lula's most recent speech. I mean, this is why he's a good political communicator, and I just want to highlight this message again. He's fighting against, you know, one of the most, probably only second to the United States, horrible COVID responses. And, you know, he's definitely going to make that a big part of, you know, his, if he runs, but I think he definitely will, you know, presidential bid. But he had this great line, and this is the Lula skill, I think, I was just like putting things very clearly, where he said, you know, when it comes to funding for vaccines and distribution, vaccines aren't about whether you have the money or not. They're about whether you love life or love death. And that's the Lula gift, to really be able to put things extremely clearly like that. And it certainly is that question in Brazil.
Absolutely. Lula livre.
Lula livre, baby.
Let's do a little pitch and then go to the post game.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you want to talk about this Amazon stuff.
Yeah, but, you know, let's do the pitch first, and then we can go to the Amazon thing before we go to post game.
Cool, yeah, folks. Patreon.com/leftrecord if you're enjoying what you're seeing from us. And we, like we said, we're going to do the post game. We'll play some clips, some pretty amazing clips from that Lava, or from the Edge of Democracy documentary, mm-hmm. including a view of just like what actual fascists look like around the globe. Horrifying, turns out. And I also want to play Piers Morgan storming off of the set of,
oh, hell yeah,
Good Morning Britain or whatever that is, because it panics, like sort of monarchy panics in British people is a funny thing to sort of watch, and Piers mm-hmm. lost his job over one. Anything you want to say, David?
You know, again, you know, in the post game 2, we're going to do bump steer of the week, and look at all these people who were pretty much, I don't even think bamboozled will be the right word, because they're very quick to, you know, to support all sorts of idiots and people who are threats to democracy around the globe. But all these academics who got worked up about Jacobin and Monthly Review and the Gray Zone for questioning the legitimacy of Jaco Perez's bid for the presidency in Ecuador. So we'll definitely have a lot of fun with that. And yeah, definitely support us on patreon.com/leftreckoning. We got some really exciting stuff coming up. Next week's show will be great. And, you know, supporting us helps us keep as much of this content public as possible, because I really think that it's important to have this platform out there for folks. And yeah, definitely support us there. Also, I'm going to get all my stuff figured out. I know I've been saying I'm going to get back on my streams, but I actually am. I'm still like deskless. So I need
deskless. Is that a Greek, like
the dangerous thing for a podcaster? It's an extreme state of destitution. but once I get that, I'll definitely be back on doing my weekly live streams as well. I think I might start doing some for the backyard. We'll see if I'm able to.
I think that sounds amazing.
I think that would be fun.
I just won't be able to watch those because it's going to make me too jealous. I want a backyard so bad.
I need the Texas sun to purge me of my sin of whiteness. Anyways, I want to do this last segment because I think this goes with what we were just talking about, you know, not being bamboozled. Obviously, there is a historic fight for a union in Bessemer, Alabama, a union of Amazon workers, which has really captured like the hearts and hopes of so many of us on the left, because it would be absolutely huge. It could really shift a lot of dynamics. I mean, the dangerous and difficult part of the world that we're living in right now is this increased monopolization, that there are a few platforms that have immense power in the society, but that also gives us an opportunity because there are more choke points that we can target. And having a union representation in Amazon could really be fruitful for labor organizing and for working class politics around the globe.
Could have a domino effect. This.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, if this works, this could definitely be replicated around the country. And no excuses about it not being possible in a right to work state, right? But there was something that happened over the weekend, and I just wanted to address it because it was very frustrating to see. There were these viral tweets calling for a Amazon boycott, right? And it was a picture of Bezos's face saying, "Don't cross the picket line," and telling everybody to boycott Amazon for this week. And it gained immense traction, right? And I don't want to like browbeat anybody on this, because it gained traction because so many people in this country are wanting to support the workers in Bessemer, right? That is the correct response. To say that, like, I want to be able to show solidarity and support. A lot of people don't know how to support, right? So you see something like this, okay, don't, shop on Amazon during this week. And it seems like something very easy to do. So, you know, a lot of people share this. But here's the thing. The union did not call for this boycott, right? And also, they're not on strike. So there's no picket line to cross, right? They're trying to be recognized as a union. And look, I get it. Like, as I was saying, like, we all want to help, and there's a lot of info being shot at us all the time, right? But what was particularly frustrating about this was when the call came out from the union for people to stop sharing this meme and to stop saying that this is something, you know, this is the tactic that they are asking for, people got really indignant toward the union. And started to get mad at folks who were saying, "Oh, actually, you know, the union didn't call for this," because people were saying, like, "Oh, well, you're saying that I should, you know, continue to shop at Amazon, blah, blah, blah." You need to check yourself right now if that's your reaction to people saying that the union is not calling for this. The union, the people who are organizing the union in Bessemer, have a lot of strategy discussions about the best way to win a union in this facility. And they sure as hell are aware of concepts like a boycott. Right? They made the decision not to do it. And I'll give you some insight as to why. They are trying to convince workers at this facility to trust them with their livelihood. While that is happening, Amazon is just beaming in misinformation to all of these folks. And they are telling them that if there is a union in Bessemer, Alabama, that they will lose their jobs because Amazon will not be able to be a profitable company, and they'll have to, you know, cut production, which means cutting workers, right? That's a threat. It's a lie, but that's what they are being told. And this is what the union is trying to, you know, convince people that they actually have, you know, a better avenue for them to take, right? So if you were to boycott this facility and they were to see this massive slowdown, that only feeds into Amazon's argument. There's another aspect of this as well. A big part of us all going out and showing our solidarity with these workers is to show them that we have their back. Does it seem like we have their back if they say, hey, we didn't call for y'all to do this and you just want to do it anyway? Does it seem like they haven't organized a national, you know, like national organization that they can make calls to get people to support them or do things when they actually do need us to do stuff? If everybody is just doing, you know, these kind of like anarchic actions without any kind of real basis in the union drive, right? This was something that people were in the, you know, who are organizing, were saying, please don't do this, not only because they didn't call for it, but because it actually was undermining a lot of the actions that they are trying to do. Again, I'm not saying this to condemn anybody who was like sharing these memes, because you see it and you say, okay, this is an easy way to support the union. I'm not making any kind of moral, you know, judgment there. I'm saying, okay, one, you know, next time you see something like that, you know, it's just a lesson. It's like, next time you see something like that, maybe see if this is being called for by the union or by, you know, a credible organization, instead of what it was just some person who, you know, had Photoshop and came up with their own concept of how to help the workers. Again, I understand that this came from like a genuine place of wanting to help, but one, you have to understand that these things are very fragile, right? And we have to understand that we are all a part of this movement in our own way. Right. And understand that we can do we can do something, even with the best of intentions, that can hurt our cause. Mm-hmm. And also understand that that if we do not, if you get challenged on something like this by the union, don't make a big stink and attack them, because you know what they had to do over the weekend in the, one of the most important, you know, few weeks of this election? They had to get together and talk about how to deal with this campaign, and they had to put out a statement, right? While they're in the middle of like doing this organization work, they actually had to put out this fire, right? Again, I'm not, you know, you whatever, like, you know, everybody, like I had friends who were sharing it and I let them know. You know, I wasn't mad at them. I don't think they're a bad person or anything like that. I'm just saying, hey, you know, this is a chance for us to sort of learn a lesson, because we also haven't had to do a lot of this work in this country because unionization rates are so low. Like, we're learning how to be good supporters of this. And I get that. I'm just saying this is an opportunity to learn that lesson. And again, you get called out for this, don't raise a big stink and attack the goddamn union because you don't understand their tactical decisions.
Yeah, this, you have to use the opportunity to get educated, because this will 100%. Amazon probably has a dozen people right now writing up this case study and how they can reproduce it in the future, right? Like, because this worked better than anything they've probably been tried themselves to like f up the like you said, like just waste the time of actual organizers. Yeah. All right. Well, folks. A half hour from now, we will catch you in the post game if you subscribe at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Thanks to all of you who do that. And yeah, we will see you then. David, anything else you want to say?
No, we'll watch some more Lula, take questions from the Discord. So definitely, if you haven't already taken the plunge, sign up at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Appreciate all of y'all. Lula Libre.
Peace out, folks.